Logos, a split-second flash of white, a red oval enlarges behind the word magnet. Three translucent letters, XYZ, expand. XYZ Films. Stained and faded wallpaper covers a dim ceiling. A window with etched glass lets in thin blue light, flanked by dark tattered curtains. Opening credits, Magnet Releasing presents an XYZ Films production. The handlebar on a vintage tricycle turns. On a dollhouse, a door opens. A wooden hand slides out and dangles from a drawer handle. The drawer opens to reveal four crisscrossed lines of pearls, which flash into a red title. XX. Sunlight swiftly creeps up the tricycle and dollhouse. A dark moth flutters on a porcelain doll's face. Credits appear, executive producers Nate Bolotin and Aram Tertsakian. Associate producer, Jovanka Vukijovic. Co-producer, Wayne Fox. Produced by Todd Brown and Nick Spicer. Several moths flit around the doll's face as she opens her eyes. The face, set in a circular disc, rotates to face a bathroom in the dollhouse. She peers down at a trapdoor, which opens to swallow the moths. Title appears. The Box. Based on a story written by Jack Ketchum. Written for the screen and directed by Jovanka Vukijovic. Inside a subway car, a brunette woman is reflected in a window. She is in her 40s, and her long hair is curled in loose rings. Her tired eyes watch tunnels blurring past the glass.
It's not easy spending a day in the city with two kids around Christmas time. Even if you have taken them to a matinee and outdoor skating. I'd had to fight with them, with Danny in particular, to get them aboard the 355 back to the suburbs in time for dinner. Presents were still in his mind.
Two children sit beside the tired woman. The boy, Danny, looks at an old man in a suit, who is holding a wrapped red box in his lap.
What's in the box?
Danny, leave the man alone.
Present.
Can I see?
Danny,
stop being so nosy.
It's okay, no problem.
Danny sticks his tongue out at his sister. With a slight smile, the man cracks open the lid. Danny peeks inside, and his smile disappears.
Gotta go. My stop's next.
The man closes the box and stands. Danny knits his brow, eyes downcast. Title, The Box.
Come on, Danny, what do you have?
A house entryway.
Who? The man, dummy, the one with the box. What's in the box? One in the subway?
Oh, nothing.
Nothing? You're sure something was empty. There's nothing
in it? Hey, guys. Chow's on.
Great.
In a modern dining room, a bearded man places mashed potatoes beside corn cobs and garlic chicken as a Christmas tree twinkles in the next room.
What's the matter, Squirt? Not hungry?
Not really.
You, not hungry.
You're always hungry.
Did you get them something to eat when you're out?
Just hot chocolate.
With marshmallows and licorice.
Nice.
The girl digs in.
Can I go play?
The brunette woman shrugs hesitantly at the bearded man.
Sure. But I want those teeth brushed.
Yeah, Dad.
Danny leaves his plate untouched. The girl taps her plate with her fork.
More.
She nods enthusiastically. Her father smirks and passes the mashed potatoes.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Want some, Danny?
No?
They're coming for you, Barbara.
In a living room, Danny refuses a bowl of popcorn as the family watches a black and white movie.
Oh my God.
Text appears, Monday.
Kids!
The children jog into a kitchen. The girl snags one of two lunch bags.
No running!
No thanks, Mom.
Daniel?
Yeah, Mom?
Don't forget your lunch.
Thanks.
He takes it. Later, the dining table is laden with coleslaw, baked potatoes, and short ribs. Danny draws a circle around his plate with a fork.
What's going on? You're not hungry again?
Nope.
It was pizza day at school.
No, I skipped it.
Well, I find that hard to believe. Come on, eat your ribs.
No, thank you. I'm not hungry.
His parents look at one another as Danny continues drawing circles. Text appears, Tuesday.
He came home with his lunch untouched again, you know?
Really? He's probably sneaking junk food in the cafeteria or something.
The bearded man sits on a bed as the brunette woman removes her earrings at a vanity.
I think we should make an appointment with Dr. Weller. Maybe he's coming down with something.
I'm sure it's just some stunt he's pulling to get out of going to school. I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, I am starting to get worried.
Look, he doesn't have a fever. And even if he has the flu, there's nothing Dr. Weller can do for him anyway.
I guess so.
The man stares solemnly at his wife's back as she lets down her hair. At the dining table, cheesy garlic bread sits beside a Caesar salad and spaghetti with meatballs. Danny taps his fingers.
Listen, buddy, you gotta eat something.
Danny, why didn't you eat the lunch I made you today?
I didn't feel like it.
With a frown, Danny shrugs.
Try some garlic bread. It's really good.
You love spaghetti.
Danny's father looks at him with soft eyes. Danny shrugs again.
No, thanks.
It's been 3 days, buddy. Are you feeling okay?
He feels Danny's forehead.
Oh my god, it better not be the chicken pox. Amanda Dewsbury had the chicken pox, and she didn't show up for school for like an entire week. She was covered in like these disgusting oozing sores.
I feel fine. Just not hungry.
Okay.
His mom raises her eyebrows slightly and eats a meatball. Text. Wednesday. At the dining table, a crispy pepperoni pizza sits on a wooden cutting board next to chicken wings, veggie sticks, and glasses of cola with ice. Danny drags his fork around his plate. His father stares at him as the other two dig in.
Come on, Danny, we made your favorite pizza. Come on now.
Not hungry. It smells good.
Danny looks solemnly down at his plate, dragging the fork around it. His father snatches his wrist.
You're not getting up from this table until you eat that pizza. Do you understand me? Do you understand me?
Please, Danny, just take one bite.
Danny's eyebrows furrow.
No, thank you.
This has gone on long enough. Danny! God damn it, will you just eat?
I'm not hungry.
His father claps his hand to his mouth as he and Danny both begin to cry.
Fine. Then just go to bed.
His mother stares blankly as Danny runs off. The girl and father sit with downcast eyes. The mother grabs a celery stick. Thursday. In a hospital waiting room, the girl eats snacks while reading a magazine. In an exam room, a middle-aged doctor presses his stethoscope to Danny's chest as his parents watch.
Any dizziness, vomiting, diarrhea?
No, nothing.
Fever, listlessness?
No, he seems fine.
And you say he hasn't eaten in 5 days?
Absolutely nothing.
Danny looks up at the balding doctor.
Can I have a moment with him, please?
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Thanks.
The parents hesitantly leave. The doctor folds his hands as he looks down at Danny.
Danny? Is there anything you want to tell me?
Danny glances downward, then shakes his head slightly.
You sure? I mean, I'm here to listen. I want to help.
Everything's fine. I'm just not hungry is all.
You gotta eat, Danny.
Why?
Well, there's people starving all over the world. I mean, if you don't eat, eventually you'll die. It's that simple.
Danny cocks an eyebrow.
So?
Why didn't you bring him in sooner?
In the hallway, the doctor looks sternly at Danny's parents.
I don't know.
Well, he's lost 5 pounds since his last checkup. Other than that, he seems fine physically. We're going to run some tests on him, and hopefully that'll give us a clearer picture. Has he had any problems at school?
No. Nothing that we're aware of.
Home?
No. Why do you ask?
I think Danny might be having some emotional problems.
The father blinks hard, then looks toward the exam room.
Now, there's a specialist that I can recommend for you.
A psychiatrist?
No, a therapist. And don't worry, he's not going to push any pills on Danny. I'll be there to help him.
Well, how's he going to help him, doctor?
Look, we're going to get to the bottom of this. Now, what I want you to do is to call me every day and let me know how Danny's doing, if he's eating.
Okay.
If he's not, don't push him.
No, of course not.
All right? Stay calm. I'll keep you posted.
Thanks, Dr. Weller.
Thanks.
The mother smiles wanly as the doctor leaves. At the dining table, takeout boxes with chow mein and fried rice sit beside tiny sauce containers and fortune cookies. Danny's chair is empty. In her bathroom, the mother rummages through drawers. She finds a pack of cigarettes and sits on the toilet. She turns the pack over in her hands, then grabs a lighter from a drawer. In a hallway, the mother pauses to listen at a door. She conceals the cigarettes behind her back. She opens the door. Danny and his sister are relaxing on a bed.
Hey, what are you guys talking about?
Nothing.
Come on, what were you just talking about?
Just stuff.
Secret stuff?
Just, you know, stuff.
Stuff that maybe has to do with why you're not eating? That kind of stuff?
She raises her eyebrows expectantly, but both children fix her with vacant stares.
Fine. Let's get back to bed.
Danny wiggles under the blankets, pushing aside a football pillow. The girl continues to stare at her mother.
Jenny, what's the matter?
Oh, nothing. Good night, Mom.
Jenny looks down. Her mother's face falls. Outside a sliding glass door, the mother exhales smoke into the night. She takes a drag from her cigarette and wraps a thick rope tightly around herself. Friday.
Jenny!
Coming!
In the kitchen, Jenny grabs her lunch.
Hey, Mom.
Hey.
Yeah, Mom?
It's chocolate.
I'm okay. I'm not hungry. Thanks.
Her mother holds out a plate with toast. Her smile dies as Jenny prances off. On the dining table are French fries, fried chicken, and macaroni and cheese. The children's seats are both empty.
Where's Jenny?
She says she's not hungry.
Why?
The mother shrugs.
I don't know. I wish I did.
The father knits his brow.
Are you taking any of this seriously?
Of course I am. I'm the mother.
Well, I just don't understand it.
Understand what?
How you can eat while our children are starving.
He fixes her with a harsh glare.
Well, I have to eat, don't I?
The father's jaw hangs open. He looks down at the food before them, then gets up. The mother sits alone. She dabs at her lips with a napkin. She places both her hands on the table and stares down at her food. She takes a bite of fried chicken. In his room, Danny sits on his bed. He stares down at a drawing as his father enters.
Danny?
Danny looks up. His father calmly sits beside him.
Hey. What is going on with you and Jenny?
You know you can tell me.
The mother appears in the hall. She watches as the father rubs Danny's back.
Please tell me.
Danny looks up at his tearful father, then cups a hand to his ear. He leans in to listen. He leans back and stares down at his son in shock. At night, the mother lies awake in her bed. The father slips under the covers beside her.
What did he say?
Huh?
Danny.
Oh. Nothing.
He turns on his side, away from his wife. She stares up at the ceiling. In soft light, the mother's eyes flutter open. She wears a slight smile and a lacy nightgown. Her head is jostled about. On the dining table, the mother's right arm and leg are carved open. The bloody flesh is cleanly separated down to the bone. A carving fork holds a piece of her thigh in place as a knife slices it off. Her femur is fully exposed. Danny and Jenny smile as their father serves them flesh.
Peace for you. Peace for you. There you go.
They all sit. The mother lies motionless as her smiling children eat with forks and knives. Jenny takes a bite and nods approvingly. Her father smiles at her. Danny swirls a chunk of meat in the blood on his plate and takes a bite. He smiles with stained red lips. A wide smile stretches the mother's lips. Christmas. In the living room, Jenny and her mother sit beside the Christmas tree. The father carries Danny in, sets him down on the floor, and ruffles his hair. Jenny eagerly hands her father a gift. He grins and slides the lid off. He smiles down at an assortment of chocolates. Everyone looks at Jenny as she opens a box with a knit sweater.
I remember laughter from that day. Plenty of laughter. Nobody's new clothes fit, but we try them on anyway. Believe it or not, we were happy. We were more together than we had ever been.
Jenny pulls her sweater on over a thin waist. Her brother and father watch her with gaunt eyes. Danny hands his mother a wrapped red box. It's identical to the one the man on the subway was holding.
Danny? Do you remember that day on the train? The man with a box?
Danny nods.
Do you remember looking inside the box?
Yeah.
What was in it?
Nothing.
Really nothing? You mean it was actually empty?
Danny shrugs. The mother looks around the room.
But I thought I remember him saying it was a present. Was he playing some kind of a joke? Is this some kind of a joke?
All three of them stare at the mother. None of them move. At night, a single fluorescent lamp dimly illuminates a hospital waiting room. In a hospital bed, a sleeping Danny wears a breathing mask. His mother holds his hand. She looks up at the vitals monitor, which shows a heart rate of 39 beats per minute and blood pressure of 52 over 29. On the other side of a glass partition, Jenny lies in another hospital bed with her eyes closed. A nasal cannula runs along her face. In a third hospital bed, their father lies with his eyes closed. In a subway car, the mother wanders, looking at the passengers with tired eyes. In the hospital, she frantically clasps Danny's hand.
Danny died on January 17th.
She stands on a train platform.
Jenny went on February 3rd, and my husband Robert lingered until the 27th. And through all of this, through all these weeks now, going back and forth to the hospital each day, I look for him.
In another subway car, she grasps a railing while craning her head around. She leans her head against the railing and squeezes her eyes shut. When new passengers board, she wanders down the train car, looking at them. She spots a familiar top hat and suit coat. She touches the man's shoulder. He looks up with a kind, youthful face. The mother turns away from him with a frown.
I need to find him. To know that my son knew and then passed on to the others. It's the only way I can get close to them now. I want to see. I have to see.
In dim sunlight, the dollhouse strolls along a walkway. It passes black wrought iron fencing. The porcelain doll's face on the roof looks from side to side. It stops in a doorway and blinks. The face flips around to look inward. A beetle crawls along a white dollhouse wall. A tiny door flips open to engulf it. The face flips back to the outside. A metal door shaped like a warped abdomen engulfs more bugs. The mannequin's hand dabs at the dollhouse face, then pats the door. The hand opens the door, leading into a dark fleshy tunnel. Title appears, The Birthday Party. Credits appear, written by Roxanne Benjamin and Annie Clark. Directed by Annie Clark. A swath of clean aqua blue fabric wrinkles gently in dim light. The fabric belongs to a sleeveless nightgown, which drapes softly over the form of a sleeping woman. Her wavy brown hair is messy, and she lies on her side on top of pale gray sheets. The woman turns over in the bright morning light. She sits up and slips her feet into sharp black slippers. In a bathroom with a dark blue door, the woman dons a sheer orange robe. She slips on a wedding ring, then rummages through a drawer with cones, medicine, and cotton balls. An ornate gold clock on a wood wall shows a time of 9:15. The woman bustles around the living room strung up with black and white decorations. Paper chains, streamers, and pennants that read Happy Birthday. She pets a sleeping cat on a shelf, then rotates it slightly. The cat remains lifelessly still. A slim woman with short black hair walks in.
Good morning, Carla. Oh, thank you.
Carla wears a tight black dress and hands the robed woman a mug.
The guests will be getting here in less than an hour. I let Lucy sleep in. She hasn't been sleeping well.
You want me to wake her?
I guess maybe wake her in 15 if she's not up yet.
Okay.
Is that for David?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I don't think Mr. Lampton will be joining us at his daughter's birthday.
His car was here when I got in this morning. Must have gotten in late.
No. He's not back from his trip yet.
Maybe he's out for a run.
I really doubt it. I think I would know if he had come in last night.
Yes, of course. I didn't...
I'll just take his two. No use letting it go to waste.
She grabs the second mug.
Can you, get the table runner from the hall closet and just put it on the side table. I think we're going to do gifts and cards over there.
Yes, ma'am.
Carla smiles pleasantly. She tries to squeeze by the roped woman, who shuffles awkwardly before walking off. Carla absently fiddles with a place setting. She picks up a gray straw, frowning. Behind her, the woman briefly re-enters the room to glare at her back. She taps open a door to an office with her foot. A man in a business suit is slumped over in a chair.
David! God, between you and Carla, you're gonna give me a heart attack. I didn't even hear you come in. Oh no. Anyway, I'm just so glad that you're back. I really, really want this to go well. Lucy has been having such anxiety, and I'm just really hoping that this brings her out of her shell. You know, her therapist says that she gets her anxiety from watching me. Me?
She rearranges liquor bottles.
I mean, the nerve. It's just... Anyway, it doesn't matter. She's gonna be so glad that you made it.
She walks up to the chair and wraps her arms around David.
David?
When she spins the chair around, David doesn't move.
David!
The woman kneels. She dazedly touches his hand, which clutches a clear glass.
Mom! Mommy! Where are you?
She stands to block the doorway.
Hi! I'm right here, Panda. Good morning. Happy birthday!
It's my birthday.
I know, it is your birthday.
I had an accident.
Oh, no. Well, Luce, what happened?
The girl, Lucy, wears a black and white costume with white tights streaked with liquid.
It's gonna be okay. All right? Everything's gonna be okay. You're gonna be okay.
The woman gives her a quick hug.
All right. Okay, I'll just go find another costume.
She shuts the door to the office. In the bathroom, Lucy has a white vinyl sheet draped over her.
There we go. Scary ghost.
At all. I look stupid.
Sweetheart, you don't look stupid. You look great. I think it's gonna really be scary.
Lucy jumps. Her mother jolts back in response.
Got me, scary ghost.
Only Lucy's eyes and mouth are visible. They hug.
Why don't you go find Carla and show her?
Now I'm a dead girl.
Lucy trots off. Once she's out of sight, her mother's face crumples into agony. She wipes her eyes, then stares straight ahead. She rummages through the same bathroom drawer, then slams it shut. In the sunlit office, David's body is still hunched in the chair. The woman picks up the glass from his hand and sniffs it. She sets it down, then pulls a pill bottle from the pocket of her orange robe. She unscrews the cap to look inside, then shakes her head.
Oh, David. You idiot.
Through full-length glass doors, a kitchen is visible across a small courtyard. Carla walks past. She doesn't look toward the office. The woman hoists David's body by the armpits and struggles to lift him. Carla walks along a short hallway. The woman scrambles to open a closet door while holding David upright. Carla enters the office. The closet door is closed. From between the white slats of its door, Carla crosses to the desk. She slides open a drawer and pulls out a multicolored pack of markers. She turns her head suddenly towards the closet. Carla walks to the liquor bottles, then sets down the markers to uncork one. She takes a swig. Carla's head snaps toward the closet. Her heavily lined eyes peer into the shadows between the slats. Her hand reaches for the door handle. Lucy the ghost bursts in.
Yes, dear, I told you I would. I don't know why you keep hiding things in Daddy's office. You know how he gets when we touch his things.
I know. Where's Mom at?
Probably straightening a painting somewhere.
Huh?
Come on, let's go outside and finish that drawing. It's too nice outside to be in this stuffy house.
Carla follows Lucy out of the office, markers in hand. She closes the door. The woman tumbles out of the closet. David's listless body flops over top of her. She leans her head toward him, snuggling. She frowns and looks at David's watch. It shows a time of 9:30. David's feet, in black dress shoes, drag across the floor. The woman pulls him through the decorated living room. Her head jerks up as a dark blue door opens. A woman with white blonde hair bustles in, wearing a scarlet blazer.
Mary?
The woman Mary covers David's body with a throw blanket.
Are you in there? Carla told me you were futzing around back here. Mary? I just need to speak with you for a moment, dear. I know you're busy with the party prep and all.
Peering through glass, the blonde woman spots Mary hiding behind a couch.
Oh! There you are!
Mary stands and walks to the full-length glass door. The woman waves cheerfully.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Good morning. What are you doing down there?
Oh, it's just, fixing the carpet.
What have you got back there?
Something big for Lucy's birthday, no doubt. You know Tilly Anderson from across the street? They got her daughter, Gwyneth, that little chubby thing.
Yes.
They had a designer in Europe build her a princess coat.
Mary steps out into the courtyard with Madeline, leaving David in the living room.
More than she already does. Poor thing, bless her heart. She's going to have a rough go of it come junior high. You know, I told Tilly she needs to get her into that new Pilates for preteens class over on Fairmont.
What can I do for you, Madeline?
Well, it's just, I know that it's Lucy's birthday today, and I know that my stepdaughters are away at that new boarding school in Vermont. You know, in Sunny Hill, it's very exclusive, very hard to get into, but it's just the entire neighborhood seems to be talking about this party. So,
would you like to come to the party, Madeline?
Oh, why, that'd be lovely, dear. Thanks so much for the invite. Okay. You know, last month, the Gibsons over on Chestnut, they had a DJ, an entire magic-themed fun house. Are you doing anything special for Lucy?
Just her friends and cake.
Well, let me know if you want me to get anything. It's really no trouble. There's a designer cupcake place over by where I get the catwalk.
Okay, just let me know. Thanks, dear.
Mary springs into action as soon as she shuts the door. She uncovers David's body, then pats down his pockets. She pulls a flask from the pocket inside his suit jacket and frowns at him. Mary stows the flask in a pocket of her orange robe, which now has one shoulder torn open. She bends to grab David under his armpits again, and hefts him up.
Fuck. Oh, Madeline.
Mary opens the front door to a boombox. A person in a panda costume hops out.
Yo, I'm a rapping panda, and I'm here to say, come on everybody, cause
Mary motions for him to stop, then bends to push a button on the boombox.
Well, hi, I wasn't done yet. I got like three more verses to go.
I'll give you $200 for the suit.
Well, no, just hit play.
I'm not Lucy, okay? Lucy's my daughter, so you don't have to worry.
The man removes the head of his costume.
I think it's gotta be Lucy.
You're not listening. 300. You want 300?
There's a down payment on the suit, and I got a thing this afternoon.
$1,000. $1,000. And 2 ounces of medical marijuana for my knee surgery last year.
The man smirks. The living room clock reads 9:50. David's legs are now covered by the full body panda costume, and the enormous head covers his face and shoulders. Mary struggles to get his arms into the sleeves. She pushes him into a sitting position, and his upper body flops forward. As she walks backward down the hallway, the panda costume head smiles, as David's arms flop back and forth cheerfully. Mary hides around a corner, as Lucy dashes by in her ghost costume. Carla strides quickly toward the hall. Mary hefts the body around the corner just before Carla looks up. At the front door, Carla and Lucy usher in a small crowd of children in costumes. A blue shark and an orange dragon are trailed by a purple toilet, a pistachio, and an orange shrimp. Their sharply dressed parents follow them in. Madeline grins and air kisses Carla as she enters. The other parents have perfectly pressed clothing and immaculate hairstyles. In the living room, Mary still wears her frumpy orange dressing robe. Her hair is tousled. Lucy trots in. She and the other children spot the panda costume sitting upright at a table in the living room. The grinning children gather around it and dance happily. As the parents file in carrying presents, Mary stares at the panda. She doesn't move when Madeline pats her shoulder. The children continue dancing by the smiling panda. Mary sips from a gray paper cup with a straw, while pouring the contents of a flask into it. Carla and Madeline pointedly avert their gaze away from Mary. Mary glares in their direction as she drinks from the straw, then returns to staring blankly at the panda. She gazes into its eyes, sown to look cartoonishly bright and alert. Her eyes turn sorrowful, and begin to well up. The panda's round black eyes stare lifelessly across the table. Mary's eyebrows begin to knit together, as her kind brown eyes stare back. Mary shuts her eyes. When she opens them again, Carla is walking toward the table, holding a simple white cake on a cake plate. Pearls of gray icing are draped along its sides. Carla beams as she sets the cake on the table in front of the panda. As Carla withdraws, her elbow nudges the panda's head. It jiggles backward. Mary mouths "No, please," as the head tilts forward and plants in the cake. Mary stares, wide-eyed, but doesn't move from her spot. Madeline stares with her hands clapped over her mouth as Carla lifts the panda's head up. She grimaces. The costume head is lifted off to reveal David's corpse. Mary reaches uselessly toward the panda, then lets her arm drop. Title appears, The Birthday Party. Or, the memory Lucy repressed from her 7th birthday. That wasn't really her mom's fault. Even though her therapist says it's probably why she fears intimacy. In a cement stairwell, a wrought iron banister spirals upwards. The dollhouse ascends the stairs, its porcelain doll head looking up. The mannequin hand deposits a photograph in a drawer of the dollhouse. In a hall of the dollhouse, 6 pins are driven into a worn pincushion. The pins shift in and out in a slow rhythm. At the end of the hall, a white door opens to a wall covered in fleshy wallpaper. The mannequin's hand slips a pin through a seam in the wallpaper. On a doily, red threads ensnare 2 tiny glass dolls and a tooth. Beside them, a tiny scrap of paper is stitched with a letter M. Thin lines of cracks run through the wallpaper like veins. The hall door closes. The pincushion continues to pulse. Title appears. Don't Fall. Written and directed by Roxanne Benjamin. In a bright desert, scrub brush covers low hills. The dry plants shiver in the wind under a clear, grayish-blue sky. 4 pairs of thin legs hike past. They cast shadows on the windswept boulders nearby.
Wait, how are we gonna know if it is or if it isn't the right way?
I have an internal compass that has failed me never.
Wait, so the white scorpion is the danger?
Just look out for translucent scorpions.
I feel like all scorpions are probably dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, they all hurt, but the lighter the color of the scorpion, the more dangerous it is. I wouldn't even worry about the black ones. Just watch your step.
Paul, I feel like you do this to me all the time. Like when we were kids and you told me that a spider was gonna bite me in the face and then lay eggs and then these baby spiders were gonna hatch out of my...
4 young adults hike up a large butte, jutting up from the desert scrub. The desert around them looms large, then is enclosed in a massive letter A. The letter A shrinks, as more letters appear in red around it, to form a title. Don't Fall. The four friends, dressed in light clothing, crest the top of the butte.
Oh my god. This is so fucking epic,
right? This is why you guys should let me do the planning every year.
Paul, we'd end up in a strip club in Vegas.
Some booze cruise in Louisiana.
Yes, how good was that though? Seriously.
Wow. We're really high up here.
Don't fall.
One girl fakes a push.
Funny!
Oh, babe, relax. I had you.
Why would you do that?
Well, because I had her.
So are you okay?
It was a great joke. Baby, are you seriously mad?
Woo!
The blonde girl who was pushed stalks off.
Yeah. You want a picture?
Yep. Okay.
The boys stage a photo with the view behind them. One poses heroically.
What are you doing?
I'm just...
Be normal.
Oh, it's just really hot, and then, you know, I'm afraid of heights.
Since when?
Oh, so what do you mean, since when? Since forever.
I'm sorry.
I'm, like, tired, and I'm communing with nature.
The other girl cocks her head toward the blonde girl.
What are you looking at? What? There's a scorpion!
No! Oh.
Is it white?
Ow.
I'm sorry, that time I wasn't fucking with you.
Okay.
She's fine. Seriously, something creepy on this wall.
What happened?
Yeah.
Look!
Fine. They peer at smeared reddish-brown paintings on a rock wall.
Oh my gosh. Oh, cool.
What does it mean?
Get off my lawn?
And they paint them into the walls to mark their territory.
Ooh, like ancient gang signs.
Who's they? Indians?
Paul, it's Native American. That's what you're supposed to say.
Older than that, predates Native Americans for sure.
That looks like blood.
Gross.
Well, alrighty. Time to get moving if we're gonna get back by dark.
Wait, wouldn't people native to America before the Native Americans be called Native Americans?
Not necessarily. It'd be early Homo sap or Homo novus, depending on what theory of history you subscribe to.
One boy snaps photos of the painting, which shows three humanoid shapes and a set of three vertical lines. Night falls on the rock wall. Comets shoot past as the starry sky swirls overhead. Outside an RV, the four friends sit in camping chairs.
This is it, man. It's just us and the stars and the best hiking around all weekend.
Yeah.
Paul lights a joint.
It's nice. That glamping place that I booked in the park, that was also really nice. That had showers.
And it had screaming children.
And paths where you can walk and not get lost. And
trail markers made of crushed natural ice cans from frat bros.
Exactly. Thank you. This is the best campsite around, okay? And nobody even knows about it.
How'd you know about it?
I just know shit, man. Okay? I commune with nature, and it shows me the way.
It shows him the way.
Or he bribed the gas station guy at the last stop.
And also that.
What?
It's true.
Are you kidding me? Paul, it could be like illegal for us to be out here. This is like a historical heritage site, clearly. You know, we could get arrested for that.
Oh, come on.
What, you think they want people spray painting dicks on those ancient murals?
Hieroglyphs.
Petroglyphs. Hieroglyphs are Egyptian.
Oh my God, I hate you so much sometimes.
I don't think anyone's been up here in a really long time.
Maybe it's cursed.
It's not. You think it's cursed?
They look toward the wilderness surrounding the RV.
What was that?
Oh, what was it?
Paul walks into the dark.
No, Paul, don't do that. No, Paul, please don't do that. Fuck.
Gretch, don't.
Paul, please don't.
It's coming. Oh, run.
Gretch, don't entertain him. You're just encouraging him.
Yeah, I know. I fucking know he's razzing me. I got it. I know.
Paul melodramatically collapses.
Paul, where the fuck did he go?
I don't know. Paul, come on, dude.
The blonde girl Gretch stands at the edge of the camp.
I'm not coming to get you. He does this. You remember he did this in the Adirondacks? He like wandered off and then he like broke his fucking ankle.
Paul appears beside her.
I was just kidding.
No, Paul, that's not fucking funny.
You love me. Come on.
Okay, we're done fucking with her.
Seriously, I'm going to bed.
What? No.
No,
it's so early. I was just fucking around.
I'm not feeling good.
Hold your hand.
I don't know.
The other girl kisses Gretch's hand.
You can put some Neosporin on that. It might get infected.
Your face is infected.
Infected? Okay. Where's the Neosporin?
I have some in my bag. You want me to show you?
No, I can get that.
All right. Sleep well.
Love you.
The other three lounge in their chairs.
Wow.
Oh, man. I got way too stoned, you guys.
Paul grins at the other boy, who scoffs and shakes his head. Fairy lights twinkle, dangling from an awning erected beside the RV. In a starless black sky, a full moon rises. From between thick tree stumps, the lights beside the RV are now off. Through a window, someone sleeps peacefully on their side. A disco ball and posters are barely lit. A praying mantis climbs a stick. The moonlit butte looms. Gretch suddenly wakes.
Oh.
Wearing only a tank top and shorts, she sits up in pale dirt. She looks down at a large scrape on her left palm. Gretch's blonde hair is dusty and unkempt. She slowly gets to her knees, her eyes wide and searching the darkness. On a rock wall nearby, she spots a black cave drawing of a creature with a skull-like head. Its arms are bent at unnatural angles.
What the fuck?
Her head snaps to nearby fog, where a horned black creature blurs in and out. Gretch cowers and backs away. The creature lunges at her. In the dark RV, a silhouette sits up. Thick fog drifts by outside. The second boy, clutching a flannel shirt to his chest, opens the RV door and steps outside. He walks through the foggy scrub brush, squinting.
Gretch? Gretchen, what are you doing? Hey, are you okay?
Jay, you shouldn't be here.
Gretchen.
What's wrong with you?
Gretchen bears sharp teeth. Her nose is flattened into a snout.
Gretchen?
Jay stumbles and flees. Gretchen hunches over onto all fours, her spine protruding prominently from her back. Jay rushes into the RV and shuts the door.
What the fuck, man?
Jay, what's happening?
What time is it?
Jay, what the fuck is happening?
I don't know! We have to go!
Jay grabs the keys.
Where's Gretchen?
Jay, Gretchen?
What
are you doing?
Jay, what the fuck is going on? Say something!
Whoa, stop!
Jay,
whoa!
No, she's hurt!
Wait, that's my sister!
Paul bursts out of the door.
Gretchen!
So fucked!
We have to leave now, okay? You can't go out there.
Why can't I go out there? She's fucking hurt!
No, listen! Trust
what
me.
Is your deal?
Trust
not without
me.
Gretchen! I'm not leaving without Gretchen!
They look toward the fog. Both freeze and stare. A bloody Paul is thrown in through the rear window. Jay and the girl recoil from his unmoving form. Their eyes snap up toward the ceiling. Jay grasps the girl's shoulders reassuringly. He spots the keys on the ground amidst pieces of glass. A gnarled hand wraps its elongated fingers around the upper edge of the rear window. The girl stares open-mouthed. The Gretchen creature pulls itself in from above. They flee out of the RV, but the door swings shut on Jay.
Please!
The girl holds the door shut from outside. The creature advances.
Open the door!
When Jay grabs the door again, it stands directly behind him. It pulls Jay in and pounces on him. The girl flees into the foggy desert. She tumbles down a sheer rock face. Blood sprays an RV window. The girl struggles to sit up, looking down at her left leg. Her shin is twisted, and her broken tibia has torn through the skin. She removes her shirt, tears it in half, then ties it around her left thigh. She pulls it tight. Wearing only a black sports bra and shorts, the girl leans against a boulder and grits her teeth. She shakily pushes her dark hair out of her face. Blood spatters her forehead. She wipes it, then looks down at her fingers. She looks up to see the Gretchen creature silhouetted against the moon. It lowers onto all fours, then climbs down the vertical cliff surface toward her.
Gretchen, it's me!
The creature tips its head back, then pounces. On a rock wall obscured by fog, a cave painting depicts three humanoid shapes. They're gathered around a larger silhouette with huge horns. The painting sharpens and turns a bright, crimson red. The dollhouse face gazes out a decrepit window, watching storm clouds rush past. In a room of the dollhouse, a red apple pulses on a metal bed frame. The apple blackens and rots. It spins in place. Tiny flies rush over its thinning, puckered skin. A white door closes on the room with the apple. Title appears, Her Only Living Son. Written and directed by Karen Kusama. A woman with blonde hair and a wrinkled forehead stares intently with kind, green eyes. She thumbs a pendant of a cross.
So you believe me, Doctor? You actually believe me?
I believe people have agendas.
A $20 bill changes hands.
This crazy world, I swear.
I'll go somewhere they'll never ever find me. Or little Andy or Jenny.
Godspeed to you, Mrs.
No. She's gone.
In a dark bedroom, the blonde woman startles awake. Text appears, 18 years later. In a single bed with floral white covers, the woman sits up. A German shepherd dog sits patiently in the doorway of her bedroom. Light pours out of her room and into a dark hallway. In the doorway, the woman stands holding the dog's collar. Both are stiff and alert. She stares with reddened eyes at a teenaged boy sleeping on his side in a sunlit bedroom. Title appears, Her Only Living Son. In a warmly lit kitchen with a stained glass window, the woman gazes out at a front yard. The boy plays with the dog, waving a stick above his head. She squints as the boy runs out of sight, luring the dog with the stick. She frowns. In the kitchen, the boy cracks eggs into a bowl. He is as tall as his mother and broad-shouldered. A coagulated red swirl floats in the bowl with the eggs. The boy scoops it up on a fingertip and sticks it deep into his mouth. His eyes flutter closed as his mother side-eyes him anxiously.
You want anything special for dinner tomorrow night? Maybe I'll roast a chicken.
At a dining table, the boy shrugs.
18? Doesn't make sense.
Sure it does. I was born, now I'm grown up.
Almost grown up. Give me one more day to be your mom before you get to vote.
You're just sentimental.
The boy, who has a strong jaw and wavy brown hair, smiles slightly at his kind-eyed mother.
We could see that new movie that Dad is in.
Oh, of all the things you want to do for your birthday, that's it? Where has he ever been for you?
How can he be there for me when we're always hiding from him?
Ambition can be an evil thing, honey. He'd rather be a Hollywood playboy than a real father to you, and we're hiding for a reason.
I gotta go.
He doesn't deserve to have you in his life. I'm meeting with your teacher today.
Do whatever you want.
We need to talk about what happened at school.
Go ahead. See what they said.
Outside, the boy bikes off. In a thick floral robe, the woman scans the yard.
Kipper?
She rounds the corner toward the back of the house. The dog Kipper sits stiffly beside a nearby tree.
What is it, boy?
She walks up to him to find what he is staring at. A large squirrel is mangled and skewered on the tree trunk. The woman claps her hand over her mouth. The woman carries a small box to the trunk of her car. She wears a short yellow dress with a name tag that reads Cora. A mailman bikes up.
Want your coupons?
Might as well.
Can't beat 2-for-1 tuna fish.
He hands her a paper, then nervously adjusts his satchel.
Is Andy old enough to let you out of the house for a night on the town?
Well, that's a nice suggestion, but I don't think...
I know. You're too busy. Out of self-respect, I have to try at least once a year. I just thought you could use a change of pace is all.
I appreciate that, Chet. It's kind of you to think of me.
Seems like I haven't had it easy, and you've always done good by your kid.
She looks down at the coupon, then closes her trunk.
Wait for my shift.
In an office, Cora sits with three other adults.
The incident was unfortunate, but nothing that we feel requires...
Unfortunate? Sir, are you on drugs?
Now, there's no call for that kind of hostile language, Mrs. Withers.
This is insane.
Mrs. Withers shakes her head and leans toward Cora.
Your son tore my daughter's fingernails off. Tore them clear off. She had to go to the emergency room. Her hands were bleeding so badly.
I just don't understand why he would do something
because
like that.
I felt like it. That's what he told Stacy.
He's just never been a violent or cruel.
I hear the stories. I hear about the things he makes the other kids do, all in the name of being in the cool clique.
Mrs. Withers, what about Andy's side of the story? I mean, who's to say he wasn't provoked at some point?
Are you suggesting that this is Stacy's fault?
Conflicts like these between hot-headed teenagers.
Stacy is on her way to being valedictorian at this school. I would hardly call her...
Are often... Very complicated situations. It's just not as black and white as you're describing it.
I am at a loss. He should be suspended from school or expelled.
The two school staff members in the room frown. Mrs. Withers glances from one to the other.
What are you suggesting we do?
I think it would be helpful if Stacy takes a break from school. Vacation, if you will, until the dust settles.
You can expect a call from our lawyer later this afternoon.
Mrs. Withers stands and glowers.
You've always been decent to our family, Cora. But your son needs real help. And if you can't see that, apparently so do you.
She storms off. With wide eyes, Cora looks toward the woman sitting behind a large desk. The woman shakes her head.
I apologize that you had to witness that outburst.
You're not going to punish him?
Cora raises her eyebrows, but the woman shakes her head.
You have to do something, or he's never going to get the message.
No, we don't. You see, Andy has sent a message to us. Over the course of these past 4 years at this school, Andy has revealed himself to be a truly remarkable human being.
A prodigy, really.
You see, every now and then, someone crosses our path who will change the world as we know it. Andy is one of those people. I hope you will support all of our efforts to protect what makes him so very special. We're so pleased that you could visit.
She extends her hand to Cora, who stares with her mouth agape and eyes of disbelief. She shakes the woman's hand. In her kitchen, Cora strides in wearing jeans and a red apron over a yellow-collared shirt. The cabinets around her are paneled in white laminate. She picks up a scrap of paper on the kitchen table. She reads it, then dumps her purse on the table. Cora stalks off. On the table, the paper reads, "Going to Rudy's after practice. Home tomorrow. A." Later, Cora wears a polka-dotted sage green robe and stares down at her white stovetop. Sitting between the burners is a round, single-layer cake. Its white frosting is mostly smooth, and neat black writing on top reads, "Happy Birthday." Cora holds an icing tool and frowns with vacant eyes. In almost complete darkness, Cora lies in her bed. Her eyes are shut peacefully. Cora's hands tremble on a teacup. Her wedding band gleams in bright daylight.
You all right, hon? You don't look so good.
I think my water broke.
She glances nervously around at other people. In the dark, Cora still sleeps in her bed.
That's it.
A child's hand strokes Cora's sleeping face.
It's a boy.
A young boy grins gleefully.
He's a little angel.
Cora's eyes fly open, and she bolts upright. She holds a thick book atop her bedsheets and dons a necklace. She glances nervously about her dark bedroom, clasping the necklace's pendant. Through the moonlit hall, a tall shadow precedes Cora as she walks stiffly. She clutches her robe closed. Each of her steps are slow and cautious. She stops outside a closed wooden door, staring at it with a knitted brow.
Andy? Andy? Who's in there with you?
She bursts into a bathroom, where a shirtless Andy leans over the sink.
My God, what happened?
You know what I want for my birthday, Mom? Privacy. I want some fucking privacy!
Andy, you told me that you'd be out for the night. I was scared. I didn't know who...
Andy bursts out of the bathroom and toward his bedroom. He shuts his door. In the bathroom, blood splatters the white tile. Puddles of blood are smeared on the floor and countertop. Cora stares tiredly at it. In the morning, Cora sits at the dining table holding a mug. The birthday cake rests on the table before her, and she glares down at it. She looks up to see Andy pouring coffee into a thermos. He wears a backpack over one shoulder.
Happy birthday, honey.
Dolly it up for me tonight, Mom.
Without looking at her, Andy leaves. Cora presses her lips together and swallows. Wearing thick rubber gloves, Cora bends over the kitchen sink. She scrubs blood from a piece of fabric. The soapy water is tinged dark red. She grits her teeth. In the bathroom, she scrubs blood from the floor. Outside, Cora hangs Andy's pants and shirt beside clean white sheets on a clothesline. Chet the mailman appears.
No rest for the weary, am I right?
Oh, Chet, I am a little weary.
Hey, why so glum? Cora, today's a beautiful day.
She nods autonomically, grimacing to hold back tears. Bright sunlight dapples through the trees above.
Something's happening to Andy. Something just terrible.
Oh, now, he's just growing up is all. Becoming a man.
No, he's not my Andy anymore.
But he never really was he?
What? What do you mean?
I think it'll just get messy the harder you fight him.
But that's just it. I don't want to fight with him. He's my son.
No. Stop fighting him. Andy's real father is coming to claim him soon.
Andy's father has no interest in him. He lives on movie sets with a girlfriend in every port.
I can't imagine your ex really understood the agreement he made back when he made it.
Cora stares. Chet stands placidly.
The agreement?
He offered you. Who do you think he offered you to? Is it all coming back to you, Cora?
She flinches away from Chet.
Of course. I wasn't there. I only heard
the story 1,000 times. And I suppose the story gets distorted over time, but it happened. And I have made my contribution. I'd like to believe that I've made a difference in all of this. I have been blessed to watch over you all these years.
No, no.
And to watch over Andy, to prepare the world for this glorious day. There's nothing to be afraid of, Cora. It is time, is all.
Cora flees inside as Chet holds his arms aloft.
Praise. Praise this darkness, praise this darkness.
In Andy's room, Cora hesitates before entering. She rummages through desk drawers and a wide closet. She turns her gaze toward his bed, which is draped in a hodgepodge of blue-gray comforters and crocheted blankets. From beneath it, she pulls out an ivory shoebox with small brown smudges around the lid. Cora sets it on the bed and stares down at it. Her silver cross pendant hangs from her neck. All at once, she slips the lid off. Inside the shoebox is a small pile of tiny, dark objects. All are irregular in size and shape. Cora picks up something flat and ovular and examines it. She holds a lighter-colored object closely, a French-tipped fingernail. Its underside is coated with congealed blood, and tendrils of flesh still dangle from it. Her face clenches up in dismay. Cora frantically shuts and stows the shoebox, then rushes to hide in the closet. Andy stumbles in and slumps on the bed. Cora peers through the wicker lattice of the closet door to see him removing a sneaker. His toenails are long and gnarled. Cora's mouth drops open. Andy grabs a pair of wire cutters and aligns them to cut off one of the elongated toenails. Cora covers her mouth. Andy's head snaps toward the closet, and he stands menacingly. Cora shrinks away as Andy lifts his arm to pound on the closet door. Andy disappears from sight. Cora firmly holds her hand over her mouth. Her eyes dart around. In the kitchen, Andy stares out of the window. A teary-eyed Cora walks in.
Andy, look at me.
Some lady came up to me today. Called me by my name. Never seen her before in my life.
Andy, look at me.
She said she knows my father. Said he's been waiting for me for a long time.
Andy, I am your mother, and I demand that you look at me.
She said I was his only living son. Whose son, Mom? You told me Dad was remarried and living in Hollywood with kids of his own.
He is. He's had 3 wives since I left him.
What does she mean, Mom?
I don't know. She's crazy.
What does she mean, Mom?
What she said means nothing. You are my son. Do you hear me? We have not lived in town after town running from people like this for no reason. They're evil. They have an agenda. Don't listen to those words.
She gently holds his face.
You're special. You are. You always
More than that, Mom!
Andy shoves her away.
Sometimes I just want to hurt you. Rip you to pieces.
Don't say things like that.
I have dreams of an empire of misery.
Oh, honey, please stop saying things like that.
Cora averts her eyes as Andy fixes her with a piercing gaze.
I want you to kneel.
She finally looks at him.
What?
I said kneel. Kneel before me.
Andy looks down his nose at her. Cora's lips press together in a hard line, and she begins trembling. Steadying herself against a countertop, she slowly sinks to her knees.
That's it. Now crawl to me.
Andy snarls down at her. Cora hangs her head, then sinks down onto her elbows. The cross pendant dangles near her chin as she stares at the floor. She reaches one arm out, then the other, in a slow crawl. Andy glares with narrowed eyes and flared nostrils. Cora's hands shake as she draws closer to her son. His bare feet have thickened, black toenails. When she sees them, Cora covers her mouth. She gingerly reaches to touch one.
Oh, honey.
I want to go live with Dad now.
Cora wraps her arms around his legs.
You're my boy. You'll always be my boy.
A shadow passes by the doorway, plunging the house into darkness.
I've got you, honey. Don't look at it. Just close your eyes. Listen to the story. At first you made me so unwell. God, I had never felt so awful as those first 3 months. I ate raw liver and saltines, and other than that, I couldn't keep a thing down. You just took the life out of me, and you took and took until one day I said, I've had enough. And I swear, honey, deep in my belly, you heard me cry. You heard how much pain I was in because you and I are bonded. No matter who your father is, the perversion, it's something unholy they did to me. And when I found out those sick people wanted you for their own, I went to the doctor I should have seen in the first place, and I told him our crazy story, and Andy, he believed me. And he gave us enough money to leave the city, and we've been running ever since. That doctor's kindness, that's proof of God, Andy.
Andy struggles in Cora's embrace.
I had never learned to take care of myself until that day. That day I found out they wanted you for their own. I had to choose my old life or you. And I chose you, Andy. I'm choosing you again now.
It's too big, Mom. He's just too big.
Through the new schools and the chicken pox and the loneliness, where was he? He never made an appearance. Only now that I've done all the heavy lifting, well, I'm not finished. He doesn't get to make the choice. You make it. You make it.
Cora holds her son's head in a firm grip, fixing him with a steely eye. Andy's head jolts about slightly. He relaxes his shoulders, then embraces his mother.
Love you, Mom.
Cora wraps her arms firmly around him, as sickly greenish light smears over their faces. Their forms blur and flash. Hands clench tightly. Eyes squeeze shut. Chins nestle into shoulders. The light disappears. Blood pours from Andy's nose and mouth. Both are jerked about. They hold one another tightly as they collapse. Daylight returns. On the kitchen tile, Andy and Cora lie on their sides in a loose embrace. A deep pool of blood runs from their bodies, along the grout in the tile. On the dining table nearby, the round white cake sits illuminated by diffused sunlight. Happy birthday! In the dollhouse, the mannequin hand pulls small objects from a basement. One at a time, it places them on the chest of a baby doll clad in scarlet. The doll lies with her eyes closed. The mannequin hand gently shakes her chest. Outside, the dollhouse walks along a balcony. The scarlet doll is pulled along behind by a piece of yarn. The mannequin hand brings the doll a scrap of black cloth, then gently shakes its chest. The dollhouse watches. The scarlet doll's face flips around to one of a crying baby. The dollhouse smiles. The scarlet doll's face flips back to closed eyes, and the dollhouse walks back outside. As the scarlet doll is tugged along, clouds swiftly cover the sun. In a dingy room, a girl in a lacy white dress sits on a polished wooden bench with her eyes closed. A small gray door is set into the skin on her chest. The dollhouse looks up at her with piercing blue eyes. The mannequin hand crawls over and deposits a dead green moth inside the door on the girl's chest. Its carapace glitters green. The dollhouse stares expectantly at the unmoving girl. The mannequin taps around the door, and the girl's eyes open. She sits up slightly. The dollhouse smiles with raised eyebrows. The girl slowly smiles back. They look at one another, smiling softly. A window with etched glass lets in thin blue light, flanked by dark tattered curtains. End credits. XX credit sequence and interstitials by Sofia Carrillo. The Box. A Scythia Films production, in association with Quarter Life Crisis Productions. Natalie Brown. Jonathan Wadden. Written for the screen and directed by Jovanka Vukijovic. Based on the story written by Jack Ketchum. Producers Karen Shaw and Daniel Beckerman. Editor, Aaron Marshall. Composer, Carly Paradis. Susan Jacobs, played by Natalie Brown. Robert Jacobs, played by Jonathan Wadden. Danny Jacobs, played by Peter DeCunha. Jenny Jacobs, played by Peyton Kennedy. Dr. Weller, played by Ron Lee. The Man, played by Michael Dyson. Art Director, Jennifer Morden. Food Stylist, Margaret Curtis. Original Designs by Roni Shaw. Sound Recordist, Chunder Bulukhan. Visual Effects by Sager Digital. Music, Henry Willis Organ recorded at Union Chapel, London. Made with the generous support of Actra Toronto and the CMPA. Copyright 2014. Credits continue. The Birthday Party. A Willowbrook Regent Films production, in association with Soapbox Films. Directed by Annie Clark. Written by Roxanne Benjamin and Annie Clark. Produced by Roxanne Benjamin. Casting by Msada Nia. Costume designer Emily Batson. Editors Josh Ethier and Zach Wiegman. Mary, played by Melanie Linsky. David, played by Seth Doham. Lucy, played by Sanai Victoria. Carla, played by Sheila Van. Madeline, played by Lindsay Burge. Set decorator, Jenny Moeller. Finishing services provided by Soapbox Films. Sound effects editor, Alex Knickerbocker. Dialogue editor, David Estrada. Sound editor, Ken McGill. With music by St. Vincent. Copyright 2016 Willowbrook Regent Films LLC. All rights reserved. Credits continue. Don't Fall. A Willowbrook Regent Films production, in association with Soapbox Films. Written and directed by Roxanne Benjamin. Produced by Roxanne Benjamin and Chris Harding. Director of Photography, Taryn Anderson. Costume designer, Nick Bennett. Paul, played by Casey Adams. Gretchen, played by Brita Wool. Jess, played by Angela Trimber. Jay, played by Morgan Krantz. Time-lapse photography, Michael Rowland. Art director and prop master, Kinsley Daniel. Key costumer, Alex Montague. Prosthetics and special effects makeup artists, Sierra Russell and Josh Russell. Special effects coordinator, Rudy Perez. Production sound mixer, Daryl Williams. Finishing services provided by Soapbox Films. Sound effects editor, Alex Knickerbocker. Dialogue editor, Steve Estrada. Copyright 2016 Willowbrook Films LLC. Credits continue. Her Only Living Son. A Snowford Pictures production. Written and directed by Karen Kusama. Composer Craig Weidrin and Jefferson Friedman. Sound designer, Sean Beaven. Editors Josh Ethier and El Gustavo Cooper. Cora, played by Christina Kirk. Andy, played by Kyle Allen. Chet, played by Mike Doyle. Principal Jenks, played by Brenda Welly. Mr. Dayton, played by Morgan Peter Brown. Kelly Withers, played by Lisa Renee Pitts. Female onlooker, played by Lisa Costanza. Male patron, played by Ruben Pla. Dr. Roman, played by Kurt Cornelius. Dog Wrangler, Greg Mazzola. Post-production sound, Redraman DC Creative, Burbank, California. Supervising Sound Editor, Dialogue Editor, Foley and Re-Recording Mixer, Sean Beaven. Copyright 2016 Snowford Pictures Incorporated. Credits continue. XX produced by Todd Brown and Nick Spicer. XX Editing Services produced by iEdPost. Interstitial Little Girl, played by Jacqueline Lopez. Interstitial Cinematography, Sophia Carrillo. Interstitial Sound Design, Odin Acosta. XX Art Direction, Puppet Design, and Construction, Sophia Carrillo. XX Theme written by Feesway. XX Marks the Spot written and performed by MJ Minarski. In memory of Antonia Bird. Copyright 2016 XX, LLC. All rights reserved. XYZ Films,